everyone. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman, and welcome to What Women Must Know. Thank you for joining me today for another opportunity to have an in-depth conversation about topics that are really relevant for your health and well-being. And for those that may be joining us for the first time, I invite you to go to my website, whatwomenmustknow.com, and my Facebook page is also What Women Must Know, because I have further information. I post on a daily basis. I send you free reports, and all of the radio shows that I do every week are also sent to everyone on my list and anyone on my Facebook page who's liked me. So don't miss out on these great conversations, and just either go to the website, opt in, or over to the Facebook page. So we're going to be talking about a really important topic today, and my guest is Dr. Richard Horowitz. So let me just share a little bit about Dr. Horowitz. He is a board-certified MD specializing in internal medicine, and he and his wife founded the Hudson Valley Healing Arts Center in Hyde Park, New York, which has treated over 12,000 patients for tick-borne diseases over the past 26 years. Dr. Horowitz is known for his pioneering work with Lyme disease and is recognized to be one of the country's foremost experts on chronic illness. And that's what our topic is today. We're going to be looking at an action plan for treating Lyme and chronic disease with Dr. Horowitz, and also talk about his latest book, which is titled How Can I Get Better? An Action Plan for Treating Resistant Lyme and Chronic Disease. A really important book, a really important conversation, and it's my pleasure to welcome Dr. Richard Horowitz to the show today. So hello, Dr. Horowitz.
Hi, Cheryl.
It's good to have you back. You know, I was looking at my archives, and we had a conversation on your first book, I think in 2013. So a lot has gone on since that time, and I'm sure you are going to be sharing with us so much more of the information, research, and most importantly, solutions to an epidemic that is not just an epidemic here in the United States, but it's an epidemic that I've been learning is worldwide. And let's just jump in, and we'll start talking about Lyme disease. And I think we need to start by defining what is Lyme disease.
Yeah, so Lyme disease is a bacterial infection that you can get from the bite of an infected tick. So the problem right now is that the ticks have been spreading across the United States. As you said, this is actually a worldwide pandemic, as per the National Science Foundation. It's spreading in all countries worldwide. The CDC has said there's been a 320% increase in cases in the last 20 years as far as the counties that have been affected, and a tenfold increase from about 30,000 to almost 400,000 cases per year. And even that's an estimate, because the testing is not reliable. So probably the best guess is there may be 1 to 2 million people a year in the United States that are coming down with a chronic fatiguing musculoskeletal illness, and they just go from doctor to doctor looking for answers, and they can't get it because Lyme is not always easy to pick up on a diagnosis on standard tests, and it can persist. So there's a lot of controversies, so I'm really happy to have the time today to explain in detail kind of how we can go through this and help people who are chronically ill.
I know, because I know many people who have a Lyme diagnosis, and it's a very frustrating diagnosis because, well, for many reasons. Number one, it's hard to actually pinpoint as a diagnosis, and then it's even more of a challenge to address it and heal the body or support the body in recovering. You know, when I went through your book, which is, by the way, just a huge book filled with so much information, so I just want to congratulate you on putting all this together. I know it's a labor of love to do that. In the book it says the most common symptoms related to Lyme. So maybe I can go through that and you can comment. So people who experience persistent fatigue, headaches, stiffness of the neck or back, joint pain or swelling, tingling numbness and or burning of the extremities, confusion, difficulty thinking, difficulty with concentration or reading, forgetfulness, poor short-term memory, disturbed sleep, too much, too little, early awakening, difficulty with speech or writing. I mean, those are some of the symptoms. That can cover a whole lot of conditions, can it?
Yes, it can. I mean, the hallmark, though, and I think this is kind of a really important point, is that the hallmark of the disease is that the symptoms tend to come and go. So people usually don't have the same symptoms every day. They have good days and bad days where it comes and goes. And the thing about the pain that is really the hallmark of Lyme disease is that the pain tends to migrate. So if you have joint pain in an elbow and 2 days later it's in your shoulder and 3 days later it's in your knees, it migrates around the body without a good reason. That is classic for Lyme disease, and we see the same problem with muscle pain and with nerve pain, which is tingling, numbness, burning, stabbing sensations. It migrates. And in my new book, How Can I Get Better?, we published a symptom questionnaire. We did it in the first book in 100 people, but we now actually did it in 1,600 people. We did a validation study through the State University of New Paltz. We submitted it to the medical literature just recently. And what we found is that a score greater than 63 on the questionnaire gave you a very high probability of having Lyme. So people who say, I'm tired and I'm achy, and again, they have good and bad days and it comes and goes, and especially for women, they get worse around their menstrual cycle. When the estrogen dies down, they find that all the Lyme symptoms comes out. So right before, during, or after the menstrual cycle, women will usually tell me they get worse. You could be treated, for example, for an upper respiratory infection or a urinary tract infection with antibiotics and told you have chronic fatigue or fibromyalgia, and all of a sudden you say, gee, my fatigue and pain is better, or it's worse, meaning you had a Jarrett-Herxheimer reaction, and that's a reaction when the bacteria are being killed off. So when people are having fatigue and pain and memory issues and sleep, although you can get it with other diseases, there really is kind of this flavor of the coming and going, good and bad days, migratory, changing with hormones. And again, this validated screening questionnaire should make it easier for people to figure out, you know, should I go to my doctor and get tested?
Do you have that questionnaire online?
Yes. The old version of the questionnaire is on cangetbetter.com. So that's right. The website, and we'll be updating it shortly. Once the new questionnaire is published in the medical literature, which we hope will take place in the next month, we'll get the new questionnaire and the new scoring. So right now it's in the book, but yes, the older version is there, and really all you need to do is just change the scoring on the questionnaire, where over 63 is a high probability, in the 40s to 50s is a moderate probability, but it does give people a sense of whether they should go and get tested, because it really is the great imitator. It's imitating autoimmune diseases like lupus, rheumatoid arthritis, multiple sclerosis, early dementia like Alzheimer's. So it's very, very tricky. So the questionnaire is a good starting point for people.
And I want to remind people they can go to cangetbetter.com. And I think it's good to have a questionnaire that people can begin to assess their symptoms. Dr. Horowitz, I want to go back to the origins of Lyme. So we talk about it being transmitted through ticks, but it actually can be transmitted through all sorts of biting insects now, can't it?
Right. So the thing is that they have found it, for example, in mosquitoes, although the transmission rate has never really been proven well for mosquitoes. It's been talked about in spiders and mites and things, but really ticks is the number one. But other tick-borne associated infections like Bartonella, which is cat scratch fever, that is also transmitted by ticks, but also by mites and spiders and biting flies and lice. So there are other biting insects that do transmit the Lyme and co-infections. And I should say, especially for the women listening, you also can get Lyme. It can be transmitted from a mother to a developing fetus. So this is very important if you're wanting to have children and you're going to your OBGYN. If you have any of the symptoms on that questionnaire and you score high, and especially if you have day sweats, night sweats, flushing, chills that you can't explain, air hunger where you can't catch your breath, those are symptoms of Babesia, which is a malaria-like organism. And it's now been shown that 80 to 90% of the time when you get a tick bite, you get this parasite, Babesia, that's transmitted at the same time. And Babesia also can be transmitted from a pregnant mother to a child. And I've had women that I've had to treat for Babesia in the third trimester of pregnancy, because if you don't treat it, it could be deadly for the fetus. So very, very important for the future generations of America that women realize this can be transmitted. And again, if you have a lot of these symptoms, please go see your OBGYN and make sure that you get properly tested.
How do you think it's spread around the world? Because it was first diagnosed for its namesake, Lyme, Connecticut. But what's happened that has brought this pandemic you know, throughout all these different countries and all different continents.
Yeah, the thing is the ticks are hitchhiking on the birds. So what they found is the migratory birds that are going across the U.S. into Canada, into other countries, they're spreading it. So right now there's over a million cases in Europe per year. The WHO has figures. The Chinese government had called me up years ago and asked me to come to Beijing to meet with them because they thought they were having an outbreak of babesia, and they shared with me that 6% of the Chinese population had been diagnosed with Lyme. So that's 1.4 billion people, 6%, and that's with unreliable tests. So, yeah, it's the birds that are really spreading it. And again, the CDC found that the number of counties affected has been increased by 320% in the last 20 years. So you really can't go anywhere at this point without having a high risk. So people just need to know that they need to really have good prevention practices if you enjoy the great outdoors. And probably the easiest ones would be to get either clothing that has been treated with permethrin spray, which is it will kill the ticks. You can get clothing that's treated, or go to a hardware store and buy permethrin. You take your clothing outside, you spray it. It's good for 1 or 2 weeks. And then there's sprays like Avon Skin So Soft makes a spray called IR3535. What's nice about this spray is it's safer than DEET. It's been shown to be safe in pregnant women in Europe for over 30 years. It will repel the ticks. It won't kill them, but it is safe. And so is picaridin, but not for pregnancy. Picaridin is also safe on the skin, less toxic than DEET. So these are the kind of the things we tell people, that you just have to pay attention, wear light-colored clothing, tuck your pant legs into your socks when you're going outside, spray your shoes. These are all things you can do apart from doing tick checks when you come inside.
Yeah, you know, there are even cases that have been diagnosed in Australia, but I think it's not even recognized as as existing in Australia, even though I've talked to people who definitely have symptoms and believe they are infected with Lyme disease. Do you have any? I have a lot of listeners in Australia. Do you have any stats about what's happening in Australia?
No, there's really a big problem. In fact, I testified before the Australian government several months ago. They had a panel of experts to talk about Lyme in Australia, because they're finding these Lyme-like illnesses. Initially, they said in Australia they could not find Borrelia burgdorferi. They were only finding another cousin of Lyme disease, which is a relapsing fever Borrelia. It turns out, though, that I found out after the testimony, they have been finding other Borrelia species actually in Australia, and I have Australian patients who come to see me. So, yes, Australia has been affected. I have patients from New Zealand. I mean, it's basically a worldwide epidemic. And unfortunately, because there are two standards of care, the Infectious Disease Society of America has one set of guidelines that in essence says it's easy to diagnose and easy to treat. And there's another set of guidelines by ILADS, the International Lyme and Associated Diseases Society, of which I was one of the founding members. And that says, no, the blood tests are not reliable, and it can persist, needing longer treatment. So the countries around the world, they've unfortunately gotten caught up in this political medical debate on which set of guidelines to use, and that's kind of why people in Australia and other countries are having such a tough time getting diagnosed.
So let me ask you this. Is there a cure for Lyme disease?
Well, that's a great question. I've been working on it, and in fact, part of the reason I wrote this new book, How Can I Get Better, is because I've probably come the closest to a cure for this illness in the 30 years that I've been working on it. And so what's happened is, since my first book, Why Can't I Get Better, came out, a year or two later, researchers at Johns Hopkins University, specifically Dr. Ying Zhang, he had started publishing papers, and it was about the same time Dr. Kim Lewis from Northeastern University. They found that Lyme is what they call a persister bacteria. Now, I knew Lyme persisted. That was not the issue for me, because there were lots of scientific articles and research showing it persisted. But when they called it a persister bacteria, what they did is they were putting it in the same category as other chronic disease forming bacteria like tuberculosis, leprosy, chronic Q fever, which is also a tick-borne disease, Brucella. So by thinking of it in those terms, what I did is I went to the medical literature and looked at, well, how do they treat tuberculosis and leprosy, which is a persister bacteria? And what I did is I borrowed some of the medications that are used for these mycobacterium infections, and I started using them in Lyme patients, and we published the first studies on them last year in the medical literature. What we found is the people who failed classical treatments for Lyme disease, who had taken doxycycline and were still sick, or even IV drugs like Rocephin and were still sick, there was a large number of patients who responded to these mycobacterium drugs. And the reason they work is because they go inside the cells where the bacteria are hiding, and they're quite effective for it. And the other research that came out was on biofilms. So in the past, I thought that the Lyme persisted because it would keep changing forms in the body. So if it had a cell wall form, you would need a penicillin or a drug like Rocephin and cephalosporin. Or it would go inside the cells. Or we knew that it had what we called cystic forms, which were also called cell wall deficient forms. And there were different drugs and herbs and natural products you could use, but we only learned about biofilms and these persister bacteria in the last few years. So the studies we're now doing is taking natural products that go after biofilms, serrapeptase, lauricidin, which is monolaurin, it's a coconut oil extract, stevia extract, a specific form from Nutramedics, biocidin, which is a set of herbs. These all open up the biofilms so that your natural products or antibiotics can go inside and hit the bugs more efficiently. And we are having success using these biofilm busters in combination with persister drugs. And that's why I'm kind of excited and why I spent the time to write this new book, is because, you know, I have over 700 people on a waiting list trying to get in to see me, so I had to share the information of all of this exciting research with everyone else. That's why I essentially wrote the book, and it's got all the details of the new protocols in this new book.
Well, that's great, because it's such a difficult disease to even have properly diagnosed. I mean, that has been a problem with Lyme over the years, I believe. It hasn't, the testing for it is so inaccurate, or has been. Has that been updated as well?
Well, you know, they're working on it. So the problem is that a lot of the doctors, and in fact, this is part of the problem with not all the infectious disease doctors, but some, is that they're using the CDC criteria for diagnosing Lyme disease. And unfortunately, if you go on the CDC website, they basically say that this is only supposed to be used for epidemiological purposes. In other words, use this diagnostic criteria for screening large populations, but not for an individual diagnosis. So the problem with it is the ELISA test, E-L-I-S-A, ELISA, that test is only about as effective as a coin flip. It'll pick up about 50% of the cases. And part of the problem is that you've got 100 different strains of Borrelia in the U.S., over 300 strains worldwide, and this one test, the ELISA, is looking for one strain. I mean, it's literally impossible. You're not always going to find it. And then they say, well, if the ELISA is positive, do a Western blot. Well, it's the same problem. The Western blots are only using one strain of Lyme, and that strain is a laboratory strain. It's not even one of the strains that's out there in the environment. So what we find is if we use labs like Igenix in California that use several strains of Borrelia, the Western blot could be, you know, much more effective in trying to pick it up. But the key is, and this is, you know, an important point for our interview, I play this game with patients called Lyme Bingo, which is if you get a Western blot, there are five bands or numbers on the Western blot that tell you you've been exposed to Lyme disease. So even if your doctor says you have a negative Western blot, you need to look at these bands or numbers, and these are the following. They're 23, the outer surface protein C, 31, the outer surface protein A, 34, the outer surface protein B, 39, and the 83-93 band. So if any one of these five numbers comes up, bingo, you have been exposed to a Borrelia species. It doesn't have to be Borrelia burgdorferi Lyme. It could be another Borrelia species, but could still be causing a Lyme-like illness. And that is really the essence here, because there is now another species of Borrelia. It's a cousin of Lyme. It's called Borrelia miyamotoi, initially coming from Japan. This bug, this bacteria, will cause exactly the same symptoms as Lyme. You get EM rashes, these bullseye rashes. You can get Bell's palsy, where half of your face is paralyzed. You can get a meningitis, joint pain. But if you do the ELISA and the Western blot for Lyme, it will not pick up this Borrelia species. And they're finding that the ticks across the United States and the world are now starting to get more and more Borrelia miyamotoi. So it's possible that you're getting more than one species, and that's the reason why the testing is not picking it up.
And how do you pick up that species?
Well, they have tests for it through labs like Immugen, where you can do antibody testing, but now they're looking at, you know, better PCR, which is DNA testing. And so really it's an evolving field because as we discover all of these different bacterial species, and there are different Babesia species, this malaria parasite, and Bartonella species, there are labs like TGen, Translational Genomics in Arizona, Paul Kime and his group, are working on very sensitive DNA technology so that if you're sick with a chronic fatiguing musculoskeletal illness and you're not quite sure what you have, in about 2 years, his lab will probably have perfected this testing. And I suspect that probably what's going to happen is people will find that they don't just have Lyme, but they have Lyme, they have Babesia, they have Bartonella, they have rickettsial organisms like Q fever, they have Brucella, tularemia. We're finding in our sickest patients, they have multiple tick-borne infections or other infections that they had, could be viral, like Epstein-Barr that reactivates, but we don't have the technology. So we're working on it, and the testing is certainly getting better. There's a newer test called the C6 ELISA, which I use now more than the ELISA. And the reason is it doesn't just check for one strain of Lyme. It checks for several strains, which are European strains. But even though they're not generally in the U.S., this test turns out that it's a better test than the ELISA. So I go through in the book, How Can I Get Better?, a panel approach that if you have a negative ELISA, think of a C6 ELISA. If you do a Western blot and it's negative, think of doing it from a lab like Igenix that uses several strains. If that's still negative, you can consider culturing it or doing a DNA test, a PCR. Columbia University is working on a new test called the Spiro test, which looks for inflammatory molecules called chemokines that are in the body early on. So we're in the process of getting, you know, better testing, but at this point it is still a clinical diagnosis with the lab testing backing it up. And that's kind of why the questionnaire and really ruling out other diseases is just so critically important for someone who's chronically ill.
You know, this may seem so overwhelming for people who think they have Lyme or have been diagnosed. All these co-infections, are they all these co-infections you talked about, are they all from a tick bite? Are they from multiple tick bites? Where do all of them come from?
The problem right now is the ticks are multiply infected. So here in New York State, where we live, they showed that over 70% of the ticks have multiple infections, like ehrlichiosis, which is a tick-borne infection you can get in the summertime. It'll give you high fevers, muscle aches, headaches, and it can be deadly in the very young or elderly. But the ticks were also containing Babesia microti, this malaria organism. It was containing the Powassan virus. The Powassan virus can get in within 15 minutes of a tick bite, and about 10% of the cases can be fatal. They're finding this Borrelia miyamotoi, this cousin of Lyme disease. So the problem is one tick bite can give you several infections all at once, but I think for probably many people, it's multiple tick bites over time. So some people, for example, may not get that sick with one bite, but then they get rebit, and that's when all the problems happen, is when they have all new sets of organisms that enter into the body.
So it was first thought that if you get a tick bite and you have what they call a bullseye rash, you know, like a round, dark rash, red or purplish around that bite, that's a sign that you have a Lyme tick bite. But that's not actually true anymore, is it?
No. In fact, the problem is that half the people in this country do not get a rash, so 50% don't get it. And if you do happen to get a rash, only about a quarter of the people end up with the classic bullseye. The other quarter, the other 25%, it looks like a solid spreading red rash, which is often misdiagnosed as a cellulitis, as an infection in the skin, or a spider bite. So that's kind of important because a lot of people think it just looks like a bullseye, but it doesn't. Either you don't have a rash at all, or it could be a solid spreading rash.
So if someone finds they have a rash, they see it early on, you know, what are they to do? What do you advise?
So if it's a simple bullseye rash without any systemic symptoms, meaning the symptoms we described earlier, you have some fatigue and, you know, you have maybe some joint pain. The problem is if you have a bullseye rash, and you have a stiff neck and headache, which you talked about earlier, or memory concentration problems, sometimes described as brain fog, that means that the organism has disseminated into your central nervous system. It's gotten into your brain. So the problem with that is if you have a stiff neck, headache, and concentration problems with a bullseye rash, 30 days of doxycycline or of Ceftin, other antibiotics, are not going to cure it generally. The same problem is if you have a bullseye rash and you have tingling, numbness, or burning of your extremities, which is Lyme neuropathy. Same thing, you're not going to get cured with 30 days. Or if you have multiple bullseyes in different parts of your body, it's disseminated. So what I have in the book, How Can I Get Better, is we have a listing of if you have a simple bullseye rash and you don't have these other symptoms where it got into your central nervous system or peripheral nervous system, you can get better with, for example, a month of doxycycline, which goes inside the cells to kill the bugs. We'll sometimes pulse in Flagyl, which is a drug that hits the cystic forms. We'll use biofilm busters, and then we may rotate the second month over to a cell wall drug because, as we talked about, these organisms will change form. So the key is you want to hit all the different forms, and you want to open up the biofilms. And that's essentially what we do for people, but we do find, for example, that some of the newer protocols in my book, like using Dapsone, which is a very old, generic, and very inexpensive drug, this helps people who, for example, have very bad memory concentration problems where the doctor may think they need IV medication. We've been able, actually, to avoid IV medication using some of these newer drug regimens. So it's quite exciting from that perspective that we're finding easier, simpler ways of getting people better.
But it does require specific medications, pharmaceutical medications, in conjunction with other, you know, supplements as well.
Yeah, for a bullseye rash, for early on in the illness, I mean, there's lots of natural medicines that are out there that people can use. But for the really severely ill people, most of those people usually need to knock down the load of the organisms using antibiotics. But what we do to protect people is we use very, very high doses of probiotics to protect the microbiome of the gut. So, and in fact, in this new book, I actually listed out the names of the companies we use so people have no doubt about what to get. So we use, for example, a beneficial yeast called Saccharomyces boulardii. We'll use different probiotics, but we use at least 300 billion of these good bacteria per day to protect the gut. People go on sugar-free, yeast-free diets so they don't yeast up and get candida in their gastrointestinal tract. And we find that most people, if they stay away from sugar and, you know, they take care of themselves and take probiotics, they actually tolerate the antibiotics quite well. But once they're better, we will move them over to herbal protocols. And again, I described this in detail in How Can I Get Better. There's very good Chinese herbs, traditional Chinese medicine, like Coptis and Hoodiana, which is also good for Bartonella. We use the Cowden protocol, which is cat's claw, cemento, and banderol. It works for about 70% of the people. So the people that aren't that ill, they can get away with herbal protocols. Even the stevia from Nutramedics has been shown to not just open up biofilms, but kill the different forms of Borrelia. So, you know, we're making some progress even in the natural field, but we find that a lot of times we have to combine the classical medications with some of these complementary integrative approaches, and that's really what seems to work best in my sickest patients.
And I would imagine that people who have a Lyme disease, because they have some, you know, have a chronic infection which is affecting their central nervous system, it's going, you know, it's just going throughout their body systemically, that's where this integrative, holistic approach is really necessary. We need to work with diet. We need to work with stress reduction, improve all the things that strengthen our immune system. So can you go through some of those recommendations, Dr. Horowitz?
Sure. And, you know, the advantage of, you know, reading my book, both for people who have Lyme or even if you don't, but have some other chronic illness, or even if you want to stay well, is what I do with How Can I Get Better is there's a 16-point map. I call it MSIDS, Multiple Systemic Infectious Disease Syndrome. And what this means is that we've discovered that these people who are chronically ill with fatigue and pain and memory, it's not just Lyme. It's up to 16 reasons why people remain chronically ill. And the analogy I use is people going into a doctor's office with 16 nails in their feet complaining of pain, and the doctor only pulls out one nail. So, you know, what are the nails? Well, the first part is infections, and under infections is bacterial infections, viral infections, parasitic infections, and fungal infections. And interestingly enough, you know, we do find that people have many more than one infection. They usually end up having Babesia, this malaria organism. They often have Bartonella. So you have to treat all of these different infections, treat the candida in the gut, and make sure that's approached. But Lyme also causes autoimmune phenomenon. So the other problem is you can get a lot of inflammation in the body. And inflammation has turned out to be the number one common denominator of why most people suffer from chronic illness. So when you get Lyme and you have, for example, a poor diet, let's say, in fact, I have a great story in the book called Brad Had Lyme Disease, Rheumatoid Arthritis, and Bagels Disease. And this will give you, for example, a good example of how this works. So this gentleman, Brad, had true rheumatoid arthritis. And he'd gone to like 8 rheumatologists, wasn't getting better. And he comes to see me, and he's in his 30s, and he fills out the questionnaire, and the first question is, do you have day sweats, night sweats, chills, flushing? And he says, yes. So I say, oh, well, you must have menopause, right? One of my particularly bad jokes that I do for the men. So that, of course, is a symptom of Babesia. So then I asked him about the joint pain, and he did have true rheumatoid arthritis. I asked him if it migrated, which is the hallmark of Lyme. He said it did. I said, okay, you've got Lyme and Babesia, and that was actually confirmed on the testing. So we treated the Lyme and Babesia, and he started getting better, and he noticed that every Sunday, when he would eat bagels, lox, and cream cheese, his knees would swell up to 2 to 3 times the size. It turned out he was gluten sensitive, so he had a very severe inflammatory reaction in his knees. So once we pulled out the 3 nails, Lyme, Babesia, and gluten, took it out of the diet, then when we put him back on the same drugs he had failed by these rheumatologists, he got much better. And this is kind of really the key point, is you have to find all the sources of inflammation. So Lyme will cause autoimmune reactions. You could be misdiagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis or lupus. We have lots of people who come in with a multiple sclerosis diagnosis, and they don't really have true MS. They have Lyme disease with other things that cause demyelination affecting their nerves. And that could be Bartonella, it could be chlamydia pneumonia, it could be heavy metal toxins, because we know that mercury, lead, and arsenic all cause problems with nerve pain and demyelination. And most doctors, when they think of treating, for example, MS, they give them drugs like the ABC drugs, Avonex, Betaseron, Copaxone, but they never think that what are all the underlying causes of inflammation causing demyelination. We find that the vast majority of MS patients who come to see us, we can get off these MS drugs and essentially treat them afterwards in more natural ways. So you've got to look for the autoimmune reactions and control it. You've got to look at all the sources of inflammation, which in a lot of people is diet. Many people have food allergies from a leaky gut. They may have taken antibiotics before and developed leaky gut and candida, and now they get histamine reactions when they eat the wrong foods. That causes inflammation. Or Lyme causes sleep problems. People don't fall asleep or keep waking up. That causes inflammation. 25% of our patients are mineral deficient. Even if they take a multivitamin, they may still be missing things like zinc, which you need to lower inflammation, or magnesium, which you need for detoxification, or iodine, which you need for your hormones, especially thyroid. So if you don't go through the MCIDS map, the 16 points, you're going to miss a lot of the overlapping inflammatory responses, and then the inflammation shuts down your hormones. So people will get, for example, low adrenals in 40% of the cases, or men will come in with low testosterone in their 20s. Women will go into early menopause because it shuts down the pituitary. So again, it's tricky. You've got to go through it piece by piece with the 16-point model. And some of these free radicals, oxidative stress that comes from the inflammation, damages the cells and the mitochondria, which are the part of the body that makes energy, that helps your nerve and your brain to function well. So you've got to heal the body, not just treat the infections, but also heal whatever damage has been done. We find when we take this approach, looking at the 16 points, it's remarkable that many people have these overlapping sources of inflammation that the doctors just aren't checking for.
Do you think that people who are most vulnerable to these infections, if they get a tick bite, are already immune compromised? You know, have poor diet, nutritional deficiencies, and they just stress, and it makes them more vulnerable are they more vulnerable to someone who has a healthy diet and lifestyle and a strong immune system?
Yeah, so the problem is that Lyme actually does affect the immune system, and many of the patients we see have immune deficiency. So one of the most important things that Lyme patients need to do, or anyone, in fact, who keeps getting sick, is to check the levels of your immunoglobulins, which are the molecules, the proteins in the body that help to fight infection. We find that we have people with low immunoglobulin levels and low subclasses that they can't fight infections properly. And some of these people need what's called IVIG, IV immunoglobulins, because if your immune system is not working, you can't fight the infections. So we're finding, for example, mold toxins. There's a mold toxin called gliotoxins. So not only are we finding massive amounts of heavy metals showing up in people and pesticides showing up in our Parkinson's patients, but we're also seeing mold toxins like aflatoxins, gliotoxins. Gliotoxins are immunosuppressive. So, you know, mercury will cause problems with your immune system, with autoimmune reactions. The mold toxins can suppress your immune system. Lyme suppresses your immune system. Babesia will make your immune system have to fight harder and can affect it. So there are multiple sources of why the immune system fights, you know, has a difficult time fighting. And if we do the natural killer cells and we look at them, which are part of your cells in your body that fight viruses and cancer cells, we also find that sometimes they're affected. So we use things like transfer factors, which come from colostrum, like from mother's milk. That will help the T cells to work more efficiently. Or we'll use mushroom derivatives like 3,6-beta-glucan. Very efficient in raising up natural killer cells and T cells to fight infections. So we use a lot of these natural immune supplements, but also sometimes need to use IVIG. So it is a real problem that the immune system does get affected, but not just from the Lyme, but from all these environmental toxins that people are exposed to.
You know, one of the areas that I've been researching has to do with the impact of electropollution on our body, but it seems to also aggravate Lyme disease. So people who are using their cell phones, who are, you know, having all their gadgets in their home, their routers, their smart meter, are also being compromised and makes that Lyme disease more active. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Yes, there's absolutely a grouping of patients who are the most difficult people to treat who have what is called multiple chemical sensitivity or environmental illness. Some of these patients are definitely sensitive to this kind of electromagnetic pollution. And, you know, some of these people need to be literally in these things called Faraday cages with lead to protect them. What we find is, and what's interesting, is when we look at the literature on EMFs, apart from the recent studies in mice, which I think applies to humans, on glioblastomas and now brain tumors, which I think is showing up very clearly in the literature from cell phones, what's interesting is it also affects and causes leaky gut. So we find a large number of people in our practice have food allergies, and the food allergies are due to leaky gut. And the leaky gut is not just due from candida, from fungus, but also from mercury and electromagnetic pollution. So some of the people have not been able to heal the gut, which is very important. They're now linking up the microbiome of the gut and leaky gut to all sorts of different diseases, from cardiovascular disease to autoimmune diseases like MS. So, yes, there is definitely a subset of people where the EMF radiation will affect them, and I don't think it's been adequately really accounted for in a lot of these sick people because we're all exposed to it all day long, so it's difficult to kind of tease it out except for the ones who are really chemically sensitive to this.
Yeah, there's just so many factors. I think they estimate that 30% of the population now is electrosensitive. So if you add that to the mix, it really becomes a challenge if people are not able to remediate these issues.
Yes, absolutely. Now, the thing about chronic diseases and a lot of these different factors is, unfortunately, what's happened in medicine is we've gotten into this habit of labeling a disease and throwing drugs at it. And I know the form, you know, look, I'm not against big pharma in some senses because some of the drugs I use are great. But what I do object to is the idea that the way you go about this is name it and throw a drug at it instead of figuring out what are the multiple causes of why people are sick. And that is essentially the paradigm shift that I'm going for, you know, in how can I get better, which is you learn in medical school, pastor's postulate, there's one cause for one disease. What we're really finding is there's multiple overlapping factors keeping people ill. And that's really where I'm coming from at this point, is we're finding that it is, in fact, infections and toxins in large part, that are driving this inflammatory response. And even in Alzheimer's disease, the recent research, which I put in this book, is that they're now discovering with Alzheimer's disease that 9 out of the 16 points on the MCIDS model has now been associated with Alzheimer's. So they are finding Lyme spirochetes under biofilms in the brain of people with Alzheimer's, but not just Lyme. They're finding chlamydia pneumonia. They're finding Helicobacter pylori, which is the organism in your stomach that causes ulcers or gastritis. They're finding the bacteria in the back of the plaque of your teeth called Porphyromonas gingivalis. These are now showing up in biofilms, and so your immune system is trying to kill the bacteria, but instead it forms amyloid plaques and tau proteins. And similarly, in JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association, 2.5 years ago, they published that pesticides were showing up in the brains of Alzheimer's patients. And if you take brain cells in culture and give them pesticides, it forms amyloid plaque. So, you know, I'm really concerned that we are at this point, you know, putting a gag order on the EPA and ignoring the effects of pollution, because these chronic infections and pollution, in my opinion, is driving a lot of the disease, which is not to say there's not other issues with blood pressure and weight and other things affecting it. They're finding glucose intolerance and insulin resistance being also a factor in Alzheimer's, as well as lack of sleep for dementia. So, but we have to account for all of these factors, and I think that's where medicine needs to go in the 21st century, because we're trying to figure out with the American Health Care Act, how do we lower costs? But you can't really lower costs if 87% of your health care costs are chronic disease, and you haven't even have a model to address the multifactorial causes of chronic disease. And that's where I think the whole paradigm is going to need to go if we're really going to try and get healthy.
You know, that's such an important point, because if you're dealing with a chronic disease, there are many factors that have contributed that are going on presently in your body, or, you know, whether it's lifestyle factors or deficiencies or toxicities. I mean, there are a multitude of issues. And if you go to a traditional allopathic specialist, you'll never be able to get to the root cause and unravel all those pieces. You just get put on more medications, which will never resolve the problem, and that create more problems.
Yeah, I mean, that's really the beauty of the integrative medicine model, and, you know, what IFM and other great organizations has done is to kind of look at the body through another window, looking at the biochemistry of the body and how it works. I was a speaker at IFM last year, but what I've also pointed out, even in their model, their matrix that they use to treat people, which is wonderful, it does a great job, infections was actually not on their matrix. And I pointed this out to, you know, to Mark Hyman and other people who have been involved with IFM, that I've had IFM practitioners who say, listen, we can get, you know, a lot of people well, but without accounting for these chronic infections. The problem is that all the integrative techniques you learn, you still won't get the people better. So It's kind of like they've needed to expand the model, and now it's happening. I mean, they're talking about it, even the integrative conferences, but it's all got to come together. We have to take the best of classical medicine and then, of course, the best of integrative medicine. And I'm working at this point with a group in Colorado. We're hoping, actually, to open up a clinic in Colorado shortly through the University of Colorado Medical Center, where we'll actually have a research center. We will have the best of both worlds, research looking at integrative, classical, figuring out what really is the best for all these people with chronic diseases.
Well, that's exciting, because there is an evolution going on. You know, I do have to ask you this. You know, many of the people that I know do not have the financial resources to do all the testing and see specialists like yourself. What's your advice to people like that? Because it is expensive to get the treatment that's required.
Right. So, you know, the reason I wrote this book is because I have 700 people on a waiting list trying to get in to see me, and I just have no room. In this new book, How Can I Get Better?, I listed out all of the protocols, both classical, the dosages of the medications, how you use it, the side effects, and I laid out the integrative protocols also. So the beauty of this is people can work within the present healthcare system, if they have an open-minded doctor who is willing to look at the protocols and use it. I have two doctors right now in my medical office this week, one from Columbia in New York City, one from Ohio, who are trailing me, who are learning, you know, how to use the protocol. So really the reason I wrote it in the addendum of the book, all of the details of the protocols that I've been finding to be effective are there. And The truth is that LabCorp and Quest and BioReference, the general labs that are covered by insurance, you can still do most of your testing through the classical laboratories. The adrenal test that I use, if it's not covered by insurance, it's about $100 to do a saliva test. The heavy metal test through Doctors Data in Chicago is $60. If you only did an IGenix test for Lyme disease with an IgM, IgG Western blot, it's about $200. So there are ways of, you know, kind of focusing your resources on the most important tests and then working with your local physicians. And that's really the best way, I think, that people can use my book is don't come to me, is have your doctor actually either come train with me or really learn the protocols in the book, because it really is all there.
Yeah, you know, I think that's wonderful, because if you can find a receptive doctor, which is really the key, then what you have done is laid out the whole story here, as long as they are open to, you know, reading the book and learning what your experience offers. People then can, you know, have that conversation and work in conjunction with the doctor, who doesn't have to be an expert. They just have to be open to learning.
Correct. And I think the problem right now, and I've spoken to Congressman John Faso, who took over for Chris Gibson, who had left Congress. Congressman Faso has elected me to serve on the Congressional Committee for Lyme Disease, so I hopefully will be doing that at some point in the near future. It was passed through the 21st Century Cure Act before President Obama left. So we're going to have an opportunity to sit around a table with the CDC, the NIH, and a lot of the protocols I'm using, and, you know, fund the research for this. But I think the biggest problem you face in going to your doctor is that this is not just a medical disease, it's a political one. And unfortunately, a lot of the medical boards across the country have struck out at doctors for using ILADS protocols. So we got the governor of New York to sign a bill several years ago, so Lyme doctors now in New York are protected. They are protected in other states. But it's ridiculous. You've got a worldwide pandemic with people getting chronically ill, and then you've got, you know, a political issue where the medical boards are choosing sides in a debate. And that's something that just absolutely has to change. So little by little, and I've spoken to other doctors about this, they need to speak to their congressmen, to their senators, if they're in a state, for example, where the doctors are scared to treat, because that's like having a war going on out there and you're shooting at your own troops. We've got to support the doctors who are dealing with these chronically ill people who are very, you know, they're time challenging. It can be very stressful treating these chronically ill people, but it's very rewarding ultimately. And there have to be doctors who specialize in this. We can't just keep pushing it off from specialist to specialist, because they're complex and many of these specialists don't know what to do. So I think there is going to have to be a political solution, not just the medical solution that I'm putting in this new book.
You probably never thought you'd be part of a political system that you're trying to influence as well as doing all your medical research.
No, I was minding my own business when I moved from Queens to Hyde Park, New York. I had no idea. But you know, what was funny about my story is when I was in medical school in Europe, I had asked one of my spiritual teachers, I've been studying Buddhism now for 35 years, and I asked Lama Gendron Rinpoche before I left medical school, well, what do you want to teach me? What's the most important thing before I go out into the world? And he said, Richard, the most important thing is compassion. He said, put yourself in the patient's shoes and do for them what you would want done for yourself. And when I moved up to the Hudson Valley and people were sick and they weren't getting better, I said, well, gee, it's my responsibility, you know, based on this model, that I have to just keep finding out what's wrong with these people and do my best to help them. And it's very difficult to know, you know, even if you think of yourself as a good person and a moral person, it's very difficult to know how far you would go in this battle. And I've taken this thing as far as I possibly can, and hopefully when I do serve on the Congressional Committee, I'll really be able to influence politics at a different level. But it is very, very challenging. But the one thing I can say is using, you know, compassion and always working for the benefit of others, I must admit my life has gone quite well, and people have gotten better. And it's actually been miraculous, because it was an unexpected outcome of kind of my medical journey, is mixing it from the spiritual aspects with the medical aspect and then just kind of seeing how things worked out well. It was a miracle for me.
Well, I think if we really understand healing, we have to mix the spiritual component with the healing medical modalities, because it's all part of the same dynamic, you know, and cannot be ignored. The power that we have within us to heal is profound when we allow ourselves to access it.
No, it's absolutely true, and I think, you know, so many doctors are burning out in medicine. It absolutely is necessary to have a heart-centered approach and have compassion, and it really feeds you at a completely different level, as opposed to doing the kind of, you know, 10-minute HMO model that a lot of doctors are doing right now. So I agree, it's very important. In fact, one of my patients just saw actually a healer out in the Midwest and had a remarkable experience. And I've, you know, spoken to patients who've also had some of these experiences. And I think when patients come to a doctor and they know the doctor really cares, and that they're on their side and they keep fighting for them, there is a healing effect of knowing that someone really cares that deeply and they're not going to give up.
Well, I think you've been very blessed, Dr. Horowitz, to have that spiritual guidance from the very beginning of your medical career and taking it into the work you're doing, which is, what, 30 years now, being a leader in certainly working with this Lyme and other chronic diseases. And I can speak for so many people. We're so glad you're here doing this work. And I trust that spiritual guidance will have an influence when you're in Congress, because it is the greatest force we have, and we need it when we're dealing with Congress. So, you know, I just wish you all the best, and thank you for the great work you're doing. And I do encourage everybody to read your book, How Can I Get Better? An Action Plan for Treating Resistant Lyme and Chronic Disease, and go up to Dr. Horowitz's website, cangetbetter.com, and look at that questionnaire and learn more. So, Dr. Horowitz, thank you for your time today, for your great work. It's just been a pleasure to have you on the show.
Oh, thanks, Cheryl. So it's always fun being on the show with you.
Well, thank you so much. And thank you to all my listeners for joining me today for another opportunity to really get empowered with truthful information that can make such a difference in your life. And as I always like to say, always honor the wisdom of your feminine self. So until next time, have a great week. Bye for now.